Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to A Real Point of View. My name is Greg Morgan. I'm your host, and joining me today is my co-host, the movie maven herself, Miss Karen D. We have another co-host who's he's basically recovering from some injuries, so we just want to give a shout-out to you, Larry. Hey, Larry, hope you're feeling better, man. We miss you, brother.
Hey, Larry. Get better. Hurry up.
That's right. And when he listens to this, he'll go, hey, okay, I will.
Yeah.
Because that's just Larry. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us. Tonight we're going to talk about two movies. One is a documentary and one is a film made back in the late 70s. And that movie is The Warriors. And the documentary, which was made more recently, is called Rubble King. So basically, the documentary talks about gang life in New York and the different boroughs back in the late 60s through the mid 70s. And the reason why we put these two films together really is because The Warriors was kind of based off of these different gangs that are happening back in the New York at the time, and we found that a lot of the gangs, the names, the situations were not as over the top as one might think in watching The Warriors. If you get a chance to, and we hope that when you get a chance to see Rubble Kings, you'll see what we mean. But it was based loosely off of actual events that occurred, an actual meeting that begins the film Warriors actually took place in New York during the that turbulent time. So we'll get into those two films and talk about those issues and situations as much as we can anyway. So Karen, what do you think of the film The Warriors, first of all?
Okay, well, The Warriors was done in 1979, and like you said, it was loosely based on real-life events that occurred surrounding, like, a truce meeting of gangs. The setting is New York. I think New York is a character in this movie, just like the actual human characters are. It's as important. And what you see in this movie is the portrayal of a city in complete disarray, just barely hanging on, and emotionally and morally bankrupt city. And you've got, like, these gangs. You've got all these gangs, lots of them. And when the movie opens, there's a person who goes by the name of Cyrus, but the members of the gang, various members refer to him as the one or the one and only. And he's the one person with the gravitas to sort of bring all of these disparate gangs together. And what he's doing is a call to action, because he's seen the landscape and he's like, look at this city, this horrible city, look at the lives we've got horrible lives, and we're all fighting each other, and we're fighting over 10 feet of turf, and who cares at the end of the day? So what? We don't have anything. But what if we got together? What if we all got together? There's 60,000 of us, and at one point early in the movie says, you know, there's 60,000 of us. There's only 20,000 cops. We can take over the whole city, block by block, borough by borough. And why don't we think about that? That's where the real power is. So that's very interesting, because to me you've got this situation where these gangs who seem so chaotic, and they are, they're chaotic, they're full of just everything that's wrong in the world. But there are also these elements of things that go right. There's this strict adherence to organization. There's a strict adherence to chain of command, which I would say exceeds what happens in the corporate world a lot of times, you know, or in the non-gang world.
Kind of mirroring the military a little bit.
It does. It totally does mirror the military, and there's not a lot. They don't brook opposition at all, and they also, you know, these gangs have a strict plan for how to hold on to turf and when to go after turf and what they should look like and when they need to be out and when they need to hang back. I mean, there's all this strategy and thought that goes into this. And these people who are basically dismissed are in their world, they run their world very intelligently at the same time while they run it criminally. I mean, they don't have respect for, you know, other people's property, but they still have these other elements that, like I said, kind of rival what would happen in the corporate world. So that's very interesting, and when I saw the opening scene, I mean, the scene opens with the one being assassinated, and the warrior, there's this gang called the Warriors, and one of the other gang members blames the Warriors for killing Cyrus, who's the peacemaker. So basically, a jihad is called, so to speak, on the Warriors, like, you know, get them dead or alive, except that there's this sort of shadow gang that's really kind of hanging back and kind of running things that says, well, they'll kill them right away. We kind of want them alive, and then we'll figure out what to do with them then. So the call goes out. And it's just and the Warriors had nothing to do with the assassination. It was the person who said the Warriors did it. That person was the one who was responsible. Another part of the movie that I thought was really interesting is the DJ, who's played by Lynn Thigpen, who is one of my favorite actresses of all time. May she rest in peace. She died way too soon. But she's a phenomenal actress. And she just comes across, I mean, to me, she's this very sinister character. Because she doesn't have a big part in this movie, but she sort of, you know, puts out the code on the radio show, hey, boppers, you know, you might want to check out who's trying to make it through to their homeland, and they're going through Coney Island, and you might want to bop on them before they bop over, you know, I mean, all of these code words, and it's like, where are you getting your information from, and why are they even funneling information through you? But they do.
But you know what this reminds me of? You know what this reminds me of? In history, going back to World War II, the Japanese, with their propaganda, trying to infiltrate the minds of the American and British troops during World War II, I'm trying to think, Tokyo Rose,
right.
It's very, very similar to Tokyo Rose. She would come on the radio, and she would say all these wonderful, cool things and make you think, like, you know, she's a nice person, and then she'd say something insulting. But she would do it in a very subtle, very smooth way.
Right.
And I liken that to Miss Thigpen's portrayal in this film. And it was very pivotal because it kept you aligned with what's going on or what's about to occur.
Right.
And like you said, I don't know how she gets her information, but we didn't know how Tokyo Rose got hers either. But she knew about troop marches. She knew about vessels in the ocean. I mean, it seems like she was sitting right next to the Emperor of Japan back then.
Right.
So
exactly.
Very, very similarly here.
Well, the other thing I would say before I turn back over to you is that one thing, like I said, the city of New York is a character, a very pivotal character, and New York just, it looks absolutely horrid. I mean, it looks like a cesspool. Who wants to live in this horrible place? There's graffiti everywhere. There's litter everywhere. There's houses are run down. There's rubble. There's, you know, you can practically smell the street stench. So very extremely vivid, I think, and it just, you know, whoever did the set design, in my opinion, should have been nominated for an Academy Award. Then there are the gangs themselves, and I think the portrayal of the gangs was, the casting, I don't think, was incredibly strong, and the sort of the characterizations were not especially strong either. I think here's one thing that struck me as I was looking at the gangs. In the first place, they're way too racially diverse. You can tell that Hollywood did the casting, especially in 1979 when racial diversity, when people paid a lot more attention to racial diversity than they do these days. So you've got these, you know, you've got all of these gangs, almost all of them are racially diverse, and that's so bizarre. And then they have these incredibly coordinated costumes that look, I mean, costumes, gang clothing that look a little, they just look a little too pressed and starched and, you know, few too many sequins, not enough scuff, no tears. It's like they were so freaking coordinated. It was like, what, am I watching West Side Story? Am I watching, you know, The Warriors? I don't know, you know, what the hell, what's going on there?
You want to know something funny?
I thought that was pretty interesting.
With regard to what you're talking about, what I thought was funny is the coolest gangs were the Warriors and the Shadow Gang, the Riffs.
Right.
They all looked actually like gangs. And the Riffs especially looked like, actually they kind of looked like the martial arts gang, but they were very organized. It was more like a subtle Black Panthers, if you can say that.
Exactly.
They had coordination, they had networks, they were probably the biggest of all gangs. And I think, in all honesty, looking back at the film, I think Cyrus, the one who was trying to bring everything together, I think he was a Riff.
Mm-hmm. I think he was too.
Because it looked like all the people who were trying to protect him were Riffs. So with that being the case, they must have been the largest of all the gangs. And of all the things that they could do, they probably had a lot more control, but yet they're looking to make even more control. I think it was just the grandiose idea of bringing everybody together to be one force that needed to be reckoned with.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And the Warriors actually looked like an actual gang, too. And that was the cool part about it, retrospectively, to everybody else.
See,
they
to
had
me,
the
they
leather
didn't look
jackets.
That much like a gang.
We're not talking about
the
characters necessarily. They had the leather. They were the only ones with pretty much with the leather vests with their logo on the back. I didn't notice sequins, Karen.
On the front of the vest, it looked pretty sequin. Maybe I did. They just looked sequiny to me. And also, the lead gang member didn't look like a gang member. I'm sorry. He's just too darn adorable to be a gang member.
But these are thespians,
should have been the lead of the gang.
These are thespians back in the 70s. You got to give them a little leeway here.
Yeah, I know. You're right.
Only a little.
Right.
Now, with that being said, so if you were to give this a 10 at being the best, what would you give this film, Karen?
Maybe a 6.
Okay. I was going to say a 6.5, 7. So we're pretty much along the same line. although it was really cool to see it again. When I first saw it, I was younger, and so, of course, I was influenced by the things that were going on and the action. And at that time, I think I've become a lot older, obviously, and a little bit more, for lack of a better way of saying it, more discerning when it comes to films that I really like and watch and that kind of thing, as far as truly liking a particular film. So it was a blast in the past. So why don't we go ahead and talk about Rebel Kings. Now, again, the essence of all the gangs coming together, that actually did happen. And there was a particular gang that was involved in getting that done. And actually the gang started off with just basically brothers and cousins and relatives.
Yeah,
and
it was
then
just a family
eventually
group.
Eventually got bigger and bigger and bigger as they met people and all these things. And ironically, the gang that had the biggest meeting was, of all the gangs, the least, if you can say this, the least rambunctious of all the other gangs. And so much so that they even got on national television talking about that they really wanted not just peace, but they wanted justice. And justice was the main thing. You know, they didn't call it back like this back then, but profiling, things like that were happening to them when they weren't doing anything, and which put a lot of guys into gangs because they felt helpless against the police and against people in their neighborhood. So the things that brought a lot of these gangs together were fear, injustice, poverty. I mean, we see it in the documentary. You'll see that what Karen was describing, what you were describing, Karen, in the film was really how New York was really looking, and it was really looking pretty bad in the documentary, which is actual footage. A lot of wreckage, a lot of abandoned buildings in all the neighborhoods, not just the one, all the boroughs. So
right.
It was pretty interesting to see the what really was going on and why these guys and girls were getting in these gangs in the first place. So my impression of Rebel Kings was on a totally different scale. I enjoyed that immensely, and especially the main characters in the film, the main people that they were talking to, who were reminiscing because they're much older now.
And most of them
they're
still alive today. And
that's another thing. You're talking about gang members in situations where their lives are in danger all the time. And these guys are talking about, you know, the things that they did to make things better in their neighborhoods. And it was really surprising. Now, what was your take on Rebel Kings, Karen?
Well, I kind of agree with you, Greg, and I kind of do agree with you. I thought Rebel Kings was very, very, very interesting, very educational, and I think it's, you know, even if you don't really want to study the gang culture, and I'm kind of one of those people who kind of, you know, looks at gang pictures with one eye closed because I can't stand the violence or the bloodshed, but you know, even if you come from it from that standpoint, this is very interesting just from a sociological standpoint, I think, because they brought up some really good points, like towards the beginning of the documentary, this notion that the Bronx, Brooklyn, most of the boroughs, people lived, I mean, they lived modestly, but they lived well. They lived peacefully. Kids could go out and play, and you know, people were able to live their lives and people got along together. And what's extremely interesting to me is this notion, it just was mentioned in passing, about this planner for New York City who decided to change the urban landscape by cutting through, putting these roads through all of these neighborhoods, which were really sort of these ecosystems that needed to remain intact, and this person, you know, probably in the early 60s, with the swipe of a pen, got rid of all of that. And then he broke all of these neighborhoods, and the people who were living okay, all of a sudden, they weren't living okay. And the values of their houses plummeted, and it became harder to enforce the law because neighborhoods weren't intact. They weren't, you know, they weren't these ecosystems the way that they used to be. And the, you know, neighbors started leaving. So your network of friends was broken because your friends who were white got the heck out, and some of your friends who were brown, they kind of got the heck out, or they got further away, and the people mostly who were poor and African American got to stay behind. And that was the situation in which these gangs took hold. And one of the members said something like, you know, we thought we had dreams, we thought we had hopes. And then throughout the 60s, we saw all of our hopes being killed. Martin Luther King said, I had a dream, and they said, no, you don't, you're dead. And then there was Malcolm X, and there was Bobby Kennedy, and the John Kennedy before all of them, and all of them were killed. And so they said, well, we have nothing to live for. There's nothing, there's the only thing we can do is get what we can get, because we're going to die young. There's no way that we can live to be any kind of old age. So just complete and utter hopelessness in terms of that. And that was where this stuff took root. Equally interesting and just fascinating to me was how this turned around. And, you know, when you read the summaries, the turning around had almost nothing to do, or probably had nothing to do with the city administration, the mayor's office, the police, the social workers, none of these things that we set up to help keep order. They had nothing to do with this. Again, it was these highly structured, very organized gangs who you had leadership in those gangs who started looking around and saying, whoa, we are fighting over this turf. Why are we doing that when we're not even – are we really mad at this guy because he's wearing blue or green or yellow or pick a color? Why are we – that's a waste of time. We're really mad at those people in Manhattan who – on Park Avenue, who have all this money, who don't care how we live, don't care if we kill each other, don't care if we live or die, don't care if we get educated, and they're the ones robbing us. Why don't we go after them? And if first, before we go after them, we all have to get together, and we need to figure out what to do to better our own communities. This incredible sense of social responsibility just took root. It's like a flower growing out of cement to me. It was fascinating to watch.
Yeah, and the irony about the film is, again, just like the move, like the Warriors, a lot of organization, a lot of hierarchy, an actual hierarchy, a lot of more discipline than we thought would come out of these gangs. They weren't just kids just suffering. They were trying to do things to better themselves within themselves at the same time. But they were also, of course, not getting along with the police and some of the community leadership. But it wasn't because they didn't want to. You find characters in this in the documentary, Benji and Karate Charlie, who are a part of this particular gang that did what they could to try to actually get these groups together. They were the catalyst, like Cyrus's group, the Riffs in Warriors. They were the ones who got all these gangs to sit down. And In the documentary, you actually see all of these gangs in this room sitting there with their representatives and Benji talking to them all And these are young guys. These guys are some in teenagers, some are in their early 20s, trying to get this thing figured out. So much so that they ended up on, I guess, their To Meet the Press kind of television show as themselves with these different groups like social workers, like the community leaders, like welfare. I mean, all these different branches of society. And they sat there and they talked about what was going on with them, what their beefs were, and they actually had a lot more dialogue. And so much so that it changed the situation. The truce that they voted to have actually occurred. And we're talking about no violence for a long, long time because
except that the person who actually brokered the peace was killed in real life.
Well, the original person, right.
Right, the original person, because remember the Benji and then his partner, the karate guy. Remember, he was really mad and he was hell bent on revenge, and Benji tried to talk him out of it, and that didn't work. The only thing that worked was that they went to visit the peacekeeper's mother. And the karate guy was like, look, you know, I'm ready. I've got an army. You know, we are ready to avenge your son's death. And then she said, my son died for peace. That's the only thing that turned him around, because he was hell bent on destroying everybody.
And the irony is, because of the networks that they had set up all this time, they had the strength, just like they were saying, they had the strength of all these different gangs.
Mm-hmm.
To actually perpetrate something that would have caused total chaos and would have been horrific. But what this woman said about her son, because there were two Benjis, Yellow Benji, which was the catalyst for the peace, but the initial person who went out to try to broker the peace was Brown Benji.
Right.
And they were actually in the same gang. And so Yellow Benji said, you know, you're a better talker, you're more eloquent, a lot of people know you. We're going to send you out there to get this thing started. And just as in the movie, everybody didn't want this to happen, and he
was
killed. So with that being the case, you would think that they, like Karate Charlie wanted to do, was to end it in violence and get revenge. But Benji didn't want that. Yellow Benji didn't want that. And
no, he really didn't. Well, they called him the preacher.
Right.
Because he was always, preaching peace.
And when as you alluded to, Karen, going to see Brown Benji's mom just changed everything. It did. And it got them all on the same page.
Yep.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, just like always, we are running out of time. This has been fun, and we probably should revisit this another time when we have a little bit more time. But do yourselves a favor. If you haven't seen Warriors, it's still good enough to see the first time. Remember, it was 1979, so you're not going to get the same kind of effects that you have in modern day. They've had a lot of years to improve it. But definitely get out there and see Rebel Kings. It's worth the watch. It's great for any history about New York's early times. I think Ed Koch is in the movie. I mean, you'd be surprised who shows up in this film.
David Susskind actually had these gang leaders on his talk show, which was pretty amazing television in that day.
Especially. So you've got to do yourselves a favor and go out and take a look at this film. This film is actually on YouTube, so it's like an hour and like 15 minutes or something like that. It's worth the watch. So I'd like to thank you for listening to us here on A Real Point of View. Come back, listen to our archives on other shows that we've discussed, different films. And if you have any comments, go to A Real Point of View on Facebook or hit me up on at Real Movie Guy on Twitter. Thanks again, Movie Maven, for hanging out. And see you next week, probably.
Yes, sir.
Take care, everybody, and thanks again for listening to A Real Point of View, and make sure you get out to the movies. Good night.